Thank you so much for that wonderful piece, particularly that last one, just leading us into that place of mystery. The passage from the Gospel of Mark that I shared with you a moment ago is a peculiar passage for a gospel. A gospel is a book or a message that proclaims good news or glad tidings, and the ending of Mark is peculiar because it concludes with the words, "They were afraid." The Gospel of Mark is the oldest and the earliest known testament of the story of Jesus' life and death. It's the shortest of the four New Testament Gospels. And it's missing on the front end the narratives about Jesus' beginnings that the other two of the other Gospels have. There's no virgin birth, there's no stable, no star, no wise men. There's no remarkable wisdom as a young child teaching in the temple. It begins as abruptly as it ends, with Jesus' baptism as a mature man of about 30, and then launches him directly into the crucial period of his ministry of teaching and healing. And the plot moves very swiftly and is action-packed. And about a third of the testament focuses particularly on the last week of his life. On the back end of the gospel, the book of Mark lacks any narrative about his reappearance after death, which the other three gospels have. Some versions of the book of Mark do have an additional 11 verses that describe him appearing miraculously to the disciples after his death, and they have the resurrected Jesus delivering stern words about how those who believe in him shall be saved and those who do not shall be condemned, and admonishing the disciples to preach the gospel to the whole creation. But for various reasons, biblical scholars are pretty much in agreement that those verses are a later addition. They're written in a very different style, and the sermons and writings of the earliest Christian teachers make no reference to any texts in Mark after verse 8. And verse 8 is after chapter 16, verse 8, which is, "Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb, and they said nothing to anyone because they were afraid." So for all we can know, this gospel story ends with the women going to the tomb to anoint the body of their crucified teacher, and they're alarmed to find the tomb already open, and peering inside, they see a young stranger dressed in white who tells them that Jesus is not there, that he has risen, and they're shaken and frightened, and they run away and don't tell anyone what has happened. And this moment in Christian tradition has come to be referred to in shorthand simply as the narrative of the empty tomb. And many who take a more humanistic view of the life of Jesus, of his work and his death, they accept this riddle, this unsolved mystery, as the proper ending. Something happened, but we don't know what. What we can say, what we can surmise, based on the other Gospels and the New Testament writings, is that a transformation was worked in the lives of those who loved and followed the rabbi. And they came to believe that their teacher, although he'd been killed, had somehow transcended death and continued to exist as a living and eternal presence, and that turning to the grace of this presence was the portal to eternal life. And they believed this so completely and testified to it so compellingly that more and more people came to believe, both in Jesus' human example and in his spiritual existence after death. And from their testimonies, a new religion arose. And the rest, in all its complex light and shadow, is history. But if this is truly the true end of that gospel, we're left with the mystery of the stone rolled back and the empty tomb. Just a few weeks ago, one afternoon, I was preparing to facilitate the discernment class that a group of us undertook this past February. And I was reading a book by the master of spiritual direction in the Episcopal tradition. Her name is Margaret Gunther, and she wrote this book, Holy Listening, which is a treatise on the process of discernment written for the practitioner of spiritual direction, which is, spiritual direction is when a guide works with someone who is seeking their spiritual unfolding. So in Holy Listening, Gunther quotes one of Rainer Maria Rilke's letters to a young poet. She quotes the passage that we heard earlier about having patience that's with all that is unsolved in your heart and loving the questions rather than becoming prematurely focused on finding answers. And she writes, "To love the questions is to engage them ever more deeply, to let go and to risk. It is to struggle with the translation of books written in a very foreign tongue and to love that struggle. To love the questions is to be willing to persevere in peering into the empty tomb. The ones who come to spiritual directors wanting a quick fix for spiritual certainty will be sorely disappointed." End of quote. And so this union of the words of Rilke and the image of peering into the empty tomb became the seed of this morning's reflection. And it seems fitting that for a Unitarian Universalist congregation, which embraces the process of questioning and seeking as fully as we do and as this path asks us to do, that we would give this morning to the idea of this loving the questions. And I also owe much inspiration and acknowledgement and gratitude to one of the spiritual teachers that I study with, Guyon Macher, and to a community of seekers that I just spent the past 4 days with in practice and retreat this past week. We were engaged in learning a process called contemplative inquiry, which is exactly what Margaret Gunther's talking about, peering ever more deeply into essential questions and noting without judgment all truthfulness that arises within one's psyche and soul and those of others, all the truthfulness that arises as those questions are persistently encountered. Now, it may seem a bit odd and anticlimactic to address this Easter morning something so understated and so ambiguous, so unresolved, as the empty tomb and the path of inquiry. Where are the trumpets of resurrection in this? Where are the songs of glory and the sighs of relief that all is well and life is flourishing? It tends to be a phenomenon in Unitarian Universalist communities to celebrate on Easter Sunday, usually in a nature-centered and humanistic way, the universal theme of resurrection and rebirth and returning life, and yet to do so in a way that avoids grappling with the painful necessity that death and entombment come first. They precede resurrection. So in the Christian tradition, you go through the entire Holy Week, and you go through the time when Jesus comes into Jerusalem victorious, and then his arrest, his betrayal and arrest, and his facing of Pontius Pilate, and his humiliation before the crowds, and his crucifixion and death. And all of that comes, and then the waiting in the tomb, and all of that comes before we get to resurrection. And so, in our congregation, we simply arrive at resurrection. But wait a minute. Without those really icky parts, resurrection is like the sound of one hand clapping, or it's a coin with only one side and not the other. It's emotionally and spiritually impossible. So one cannot rise if one has not been first laid low. One cannot rise if one has not first been laid low. The dear poet Khalil Gibran expressed this so tenderly when he wrote, "Even as the stone of the fruit must break, that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain. and you would accept the seasons of your heart, even as you have always accepted the seasons that pass over your fields, and you would watch with serenity through the winters of your grief. Even if rising comes eventually after being laid low, perhaps glory and flourishing cannot be compelled into being simply by declaring that it is so on a day prescribed by tradition to be a day in which we proclaim glory and resurrection. How many of us are truly in that state just now, even if we long for it? Instead, let us consider and honor the path toward resurrection and rebirth, the unfolding journey of seeking that takes us from brokenness and confusion to the bright clarity and confidence of the human being fully alive. There is a path between being laid low and being reborn, and that's the path of inquiry. During the recent retreat I just mentioned, we undertook a morning of inquiring into the experience of being laid low, the experiences we've all had of devastation, perhaps from loss of love, from death, or from a loss of standing, perhaps from shame or failure. We all experience these things repeatedly in our lives. It's absolutely inevitable. It's part of becoming a mature human being to go through that. So we were looking at this experience and its place in the path of faith. And one of my fellow seekers was exploring the ways in which she has always prematurely tried to put a positive spin on such painful experiences, moving quickly into action, moving quickly into corrective measures, because, she said, if I actually just felt those feelings, I believe I would surely die. And so our inquiry together became an exploration of that dark portal. If I felt those feelings, I would surely die. And what would dying actually mean for her? Who or what would die? What shell of self would disintegrate? Who or what would survive that death? What would be revealed in such a dying? And she realized through peering into those questions with patience and compassion and love that something quite unassailable in her inner self would survive the death undamaged. That diamond part of herself would in fact be all the stronger for having been called forth and revealed and recognized if she were to go through the portal. And she saw that the path of faith is not an effort to put a positive spin on experiences of pain and deep confusion, but like the tenderest of parents holds a child that has fallen and is crying in fear and bewilderment, faith holds without judgment the experience of the loss of faith. The path of faith holds those periods when we lose faith. Her habit of trying not to go through the door of feeling loss, but instead to fix the problem as soon as possible, kept her from knowing this shining seed of herself that is not injured by the devastations of life, or at least is not destroyed. Well, we all have these questions, these riddles of self and life and work and relationship that simply will not go away, that remain perpetually unsolved. We come back to them again and again. And sometimes, eventually, we complete something and we move to a new riddle, but there are always is going to be in our lives these unsolved questions. And what might your question, your questions, or your great riddle be right now? What if you did not try to solve the riddle, but kept asking and asking and then listening to yourself answer as honestly as possible in that asking? Remember that loving the questions doesn't mean hanging out indefinitely in a passive or unintentional state. It doesn't mean settling down permanently into, I don't know, or there is no answer, or anything goes, or I give up, or whatever. It's not hanging out there. It's an intentional process of inquiring and staying with the inquiry. Although Rilke says, don't seek the answers just yet, I think what he means is don't seek finality. Don't seek an arrival that makes everything tidy and decisive and safe. Don't seek answers that will close off the path of inquiry, the path of holy curiosity and unfolding discovery. We are to keep peering inquisitively and patiently into the darkness, into the mist, into the depths of our hearts and intuitions, into the riddles and challenges, and even the shaming dimensions of our lives, asking these riddles to reveal their secrets to us. In one of his poems, Rilke says, "Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final." No feeling is final, but many feelings are profoundly truthful. And loving the questions means loving and allowing those knowings that arise when you respond truthfully and honestly to a question. One of the exercises of inquiry and discernment, which we practice in our discernment class, is having a trusted friend ask you the same question over and over and over again. Each time it is asked, you make a simple effort to answer what comes to you in the moment. Not a long-winded story, not an explanation, just a simple occurrence. What comes to you briefly in that moment? And so you answer the question, and the friend says, thank you. And then they ask you the question again. In our discernment class, we explored the question, who are you? And so we paired off, and one person would ask the other person, who are you? And that person would strive to say something about that, and they would say, thank you. Who are you? And we continued that practice for a long time. And after many repetitions, one might feel that there's nothing else to be said, or one might begin to get uncomfortable or become irritated with being asked. And yet with this process, we reveal the layers of what we think about ourselves, and we peel them back one by one, and eventually we begin to get to the depths of ourselves and our deeper knowings, or our deeper unknowings about who we are. So if you have a riddle that persists, perhaps you can do this exercise with a friend. Frame the question simply and directly, and allow yourself to be asked that question again and again. With each answer, the friend says thank you and asks it again. And just as a point of technique, how you frame the questions is important. You don't necessarily want to ask the question, what should I do about such and such? You might ask the question, what would happen if I did such and such? You don't want to ask a question that you can answer with yes or no, something that leads continuously to an opening. So with such explorations, we learn patience and compassion toward all that is unsolved. Instead of coming at the difficult mysteries and ongoing struggles with a club and demanding that they be over because we should not have this happening to us, or we should not be confused or unknowing, and what's wrong with us that we're in this place? The fact is, we're simply here. And we grow forward into our lives, into our fullness, into our times of rebirth, through the journey of curiosity toward all that is truthful and real. And it takes as long as it takes. Some riddles tease us for weeks, some for months, some for years, and some for a whole lifetime. Yet these riddles can be sweet companions, dearest friends to our spiritual unfolding. And I'll leave you with another passage from Rilke's letters to a young poet. He says, there is no measuring with time. A year doesn't matter, and 10 years are nothing. It means not numbering and counting, but ripening. Like a tree which doesn't force its sap and stands confidently in the storms of spring, unafraid that afterward summer may not come. For it does come. It comes to those who are patient, who are there as if eternity lay before them, unconcernedly silent and vast. I learn this every day of my life, learn it with pain I am grateful for. Patience is everything. And so let us learn from these little buds, these tiny eggs of birds and frogs and the green shoots that are appearing just now in the springtime. Let's learn their secret of very gradual unfolding and know that all birthing takes its time, but it does come. And may it come to your heart and your spirit, your body, your life, your creative imagination, all in good time.